This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Katie Greifeld in for Tim Stenovek. Hey, Katie, some of the headlines that we saw when it comes to COVID today, the President Biden coming out saying his administration will double its order of rapid tests to send to Americans while also distributing high-quality masks to help fight a surge of cases of the Omicron variant, right? That's something I know Mike and I were just talking about, the quality of masks. It's a difference. It matters.
Yeah, in my life, I mean, I would love to get my hands on one of those masks, but I'm trying to order them off of Amazon, and it's you know, that's a chunk of change.
Yeah, it's a chunk of change if you can get them. Hey, let's see what he is seeing when it comes to the latest headlines. By the way, China detecting Omicron in a second major port city, so we continue to see outbreaks certainly around the world, and for them, it's tougher ahead of those Olympics. Dr. Andy Pekosh is back with us, professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. He joins us once again on the phone from Baltimore. Dr. Pekosh, good to have you back here on Bloomberg with Katie and myself. How are you, and what's the latest from your perspective and the headlines that we really need to be paying attention to?
Well, you can see that the case surges with Omicron are still at, unfathomably high levels. I know there are some parts of the country that are hoping to see a plateau, but at the end of the day, we are at such a high level of cases that even if things started to go down, we would be at high levels of cases for a week or maybe even more. So it's really a matter of dealing with the surge that's ongoing right now and dealing with it with the lack of certain essential things that we need, like you were mentioning before, testing and various other things.
And doctor, I mean, it seems like the narrative around the Omicron variant is that it's less severe. You know, you're going to get sick, but maybe it's, equivalent to the common cold. I know that hasn't been the case for everyone. But my dad has been joking for weeks that he doesn't want to get Omicron. He wants to get the variant that comes after Omicron because it feels like it's been getting less and less severe. But does the science actually work that way? I mean, should we believe that the next variant that comes along will be even milder?
Yeah, no. Unfortunately, the science doesn't suggest how COVID-19 disease is going to change in the future. Mm. I think even with Omicron, if you're unvaccinated, I would be very concerned about getting infected with Omicron if you were unvaccinated, because those are the people that are in the hospital right now that still represent the majority of people with the severe disease. For the rest of the population, particularly because of our immunity that we have from vaccines, those vaccine-induced immunity doesn't protect us from infection, but it is lessening disease severity, lessening symptoms. It's very similar to what we talk about on an annual basis with influenza vaccines. The vaccines are now not preventing infection as efficiently as we maybe would like them, but they really are protecting against severe disease and quickening the course of the infection in individuals.
So when you look into your crystal ball, I'm curious, we keep thinking, all right, it does feel like certainly better than where we were a year ago, but it still is staggering to think we are in year three of this. Dr. Pekosh, I guess I'm trying to get my head around that. Will I always probably be living in a world with COVID, but will it get to a point where I look at COVID just like a case of the flu? And I shouldn't say just, because the common flu every year kills thousands of people too, right?
Absolutely. But I think if there is a sort of a silver lining here, it's clear that people who are vaccinated and who have subsequently gotten infected have an amazingly strong immune response that's not only very high, but it's also broad, meaning that it recognizes lots of different variants that have been through the population already. So this combination of vaccination and infection is going to put us at a place where severe disease for at least most of the population is going to be somewhat unlikely. We'll need boosters periodically to maintain that. My real worry, though, is, we really don't know about the high-risk population. So we know the elderly are more predisposed to severe disease. We know there's certain medical conditions that make you predisposed to severe disease. Those are the populations we're really going to have to keep an eye on as we go forward, because we want to make sure that we're protecting them as well as much as we're protecting the healthy part of the population.
And doctor, we don't have much time left, but I would love to hear your perspective on tests, because, I mean, just in my own personal life, I've heard some mistrust about rapid tests that, you know, they're kind of faulty, that the PCR is the gold standard. That's what you got to get. What do you think?
Rapid tests work, particularly when you're showing symptoms. And so they'll help you know if you're infected with COVID-19 or if with something else. Given the test shortage, though, I think a simple thing to remind people of is if you've got some sort of respiratory symptoms, stay home, period. If you're infected, you may be infected with COVID, you may be infected with flu, you may be infected with something. So if you don't have access to a test, just keep the simple basic principles of if you're feeling ill, stay away, use the rapid antigen tests if you have them when you're symptomatic, and then always with a positive rapid antigen test, confirm that with a PCR test, because that means you have COVID mm-hmm. and you need to get your numbers into the public health monitoring system.
All right. We always appreciate time with you. Dr. Andy Pekosh, he's professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health. And of course, as we mentioned, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Katie, real quickly, you can call your dad.
Hope he was listening, because that was some good information there.
We're going to send him the podcast. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Katie, we talked about it. There's a bunch of Goldman stories on the Bloomberg that are catching people's attention. Mm-hmm. I love the headline about the Goldman trading desk. We haven't got their earnings yet, but they're giving us a little bit of a preview, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is interesting because it's about commodities, which I know we're about to get into, but feels like the bright spot for so long has been fixed income. But I don't know. We'll see. Maybe the leadership is changing.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. We're going to get into that with our own Sri Natarajan. He's finance reporter at Bloomberg News. He's on the phone in New York City. Sri, great to have you here with us. We mentioned a Most Read. It's a Bloomberg exclusive about their trading desk, their commodities trading desk. What's going on?
Again, it's truly a window into the kind of success that Wall Street trading operations have seen in the last 2 years. The Goldman commodities business is expected to post the best performance in over a decade. And that mirrors the kind of excessive success you've seen at Goldman Sachs and other banks. But it is a little more special than that. At Goldman Sachs, the commodities business does have pride of place. It was the business from which you had senior leaders who went on to run trading, investment management, HR, and even all of the firms, including President and CEO Lloyd Blankfein and Gary Cohn, all came through the commodities business. And in 2017 through 2016, 17, 18, there was a real worry that the business was in serious decline, mirroring the what people felt was a secular decline in trading across Wall Street. But much like everything else that these businesses have touched since the onset of the pandemic, you have seen a remarkable turnaround in the fortune, and commodities is just a microcosm of that.
And so I love the headline that this trading desk, the commodities desk, it dodged the axe, minting billions again. But, I mean, it feels very fickle that obviously we've seen a ton of just chaos almost in the energy markets. But, I mean, could the axe come again when things inevitably slow down? Or does this, the fact that they are so profitable right now, does that buy them time?
Yeah, Katie, you're absolutely right about the whole idea of it being fickle, because remember, when it was at its lowest point in 2017, the business was pulling in revenue that was less than 10% of what it would normally do in its best years. There were serious worries, and at that time, a firm like Goldman Sachs was also having a leadership transition where instead of the traders who ruled the firm, you had a bunch of advisory bankers suddenly rising to the top. And when those people look at a business like a commodities trading desk, they see something that's scary, complicated, and volatile that sucks up way too much capital, paltry revenues, and return on equities that would antagonize and scare away a lot of shareholders. But those who wanted to stick it out and those who wanted to keep the business made the point that it is counter-cyclical in nature. It has its best years and moments of turbulence. The best performances for that desk was it sort of in the 2007, 8, 9, 10 period when not a lot of other things were going great in finance. And now, since the onset of the pandemic, when you have negative oil prices and then shooting back up to $80, you have a power grid failures in the U.S., frenzied price action in the European gas and power markets. When you have a business that is able to participate in all those price moves, they will come out looking good. And that's what Goldman Sachs has done.
What are the longer term implications of this, Sri, in terms of, I'm thinking of other firms who are looking at this. I mean, I don't know, what changes, if anything?
Much like we talked about how the commodities business is a microcosm of what's happening across all of trading, it's also a window into what the commodities business itself is looking like. Goldman's in-house analyst, Jeff Curry, a widely followed voice in energy markets, came out and said that, you know, we're entering another super cycle that could last another decade. Jeff Curry first rose to prominence in the mid-2000s when he called a bull market that was going to be in place and last for a while because of the China-driven boom. And he forecast oil prices going above $100. He was right. Ultimately, it went up to about $140. And when he says that this period of a lot of interesting price action will continue to take place for over a decade, you will be surprised if suddenly a lot of other banks are thinking about beefing up their trading operations, trying to become more visible. You have to be committed and you have to be certain you want to take the plunge because there will be a lot of costs associated with the business and a lot of capital charges, so you better be prepared to guts it out. But the rewards can be plenty and pretty if you end up on top of the pile.
And Sri, we have just about 40 seconds, but I am curious. I mentioned fixed income trading. That had been the bright spot, it felt like, through the pandemic. But we got those Jefferies results yesterday. You saw a big drop off there, at least for this quarter. I mean, are the energy traders expected to be the all-stars?
Look, the energy trading desk sits within fixed income, and when the Jefferies fixed income numbers came through, you saw what happened. They posted a slowdown in the FIG business, and the shares at one point were down 10% for the day. So when the banks report earnings over the next week, it will be a tale of two halves. Everyone will look at a rearview mirror and will be very pleased with how they performed. They will be extremely keen to hear their forecasts and predictions for what lies ahead, because that's what is really going to affect the stock price movement. They want to see if that bullish action that we've seen over the last 12 months can stay in place, or we're awaiting a slowdown.
All right. Good stuff. As I mentioned, there's like three stories among the top 10 on the Bloomberg, among the most read, and that includes Sri's exclusive. Sri Natarajan, finance reporter at Bloomberg News with the latest on Goldman Sachs, stock up about 0.5% today.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Katie, the Bloomberg Business Week year ahead issue, it's out. They are looking at the trends, the companies, the movements, the things that you're really going to watch out for this year. And that includes a story on Hollywood heading back to theaters and really hoping that moviegoers end up following. That new issue is out on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/Business Week, and also on the Bloomberg Terminal. Let's bring in Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber. He's on the Access line in Brooklyn, along with Bloomberg News reporter Brian Eckhouse on the phone in LA. Joel, have you been back to a movie theater?
I have, and it was like one of my favorite moments in the pandemic. It was like, you know, wanted to make sure that I saw Dune on a big screen, and it was totally worth it. I love doing it. And, you know, if it weren't for Omicron, I would be there like every week, I think. Mm-hmm. So I'm bullish on movie theaters in general. I think it's a thing that people love doing, and they want to be doing it again. And I think Hollywood feels the same, right, Brian?
Yeah, they do. There's definitely a big push to get big films, established films, names, The Batman coming in March and others, to try to make an event, an experience again. Dune was available on HBO Max. That's where I saw it. It was beautiful, but didn't have the sweep that you would have seen on a big screen that Joel had.
Okay. I'm curious to hear.
You haven't been, have you?
I have not been. The last movie I saw in theaters, January 2020, Cats. Have not been back since.
Long time.
Fitting.
I could have guessed that's what you saw.
I know. Unfortunately, I have a very defined brand. But in any case, Brian, Talk to me about, you know, the theater exclusivity, because you have sort of seen this trend emerge where, okay, a movie will get released in theaters, it's exclusive to theaters for 45 days, I think is the stat I saw, and then it's available online on streaming services. I mean, is that the way of the future, or are theaters trying to change that?
Well, it's the way of right now. Before the pandemic, you know, we would see films come out on streaming services maybe 3 months after it hits theaters. Before then, it was a lot longer of a time period. Last year, some of the studios, including Warner Brothers, they put films simultaneously in theaters and on services like HBO Max. Theaters didn't like that. It really crimped their receipts. So it's sort of a compromise, an experiment going forward to doing that 45-day thing you're talking about, really have films in theaters if it hits theaters for, you know, a month and a half, and then it'll hit HBO Max, it'll hit Peacock, Paramount Plus, and others.
So Brian, talk to us about what it's going to take for you to go into a theater. Is it going to be Tom Cruise? And is it going to be Tom Cruise Top Gun, or is it going to be Tom Cruise Mission Impossible?
That's a good question. Before Omicron, I was looking forward to seeing Licorice Pizza, which is in theaters right now, the latest Paul Thomas Anderson movie. I haven't seen it yet. Looking forward to seeing it. I think The Batman in March might be what gets me out next.
And what about Hollywood? Like the first movie that we're really going to see this strategy come to bear on is going to be Ambulance, right?
That's one of the first coming out. Peacock's film. It's a Universal film that'll hit theaters in April. And then 45 days later, it'll be on Peacock. I think we're going to see a film that came out last week, 355 from Universal, very similar, will be on Peacock probably in late February.
You know, I do wonder, too, about the increased competition just for talent and content, right? The streaming services are still going to be competing for lots of stuff. You know, what does this do to the price of things, especially as we kind of increasingly move towards normal? Any indications? I mean, it sounds like box office receipts are still going to be a little bit down once we get back to a little bit more normal.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see receipts be below where they were before the pandemic, although it'll almost certainly be nearly double what it was last year. So theaters are going to see a bit of a return, not what it was, you know, pre-COVID. In terms of the streaming sites, you know, they're focusing really heavily, as you said, on driving new subscriptions, on growth. And for a lot of the studios, they're focused increasingly on these services, even more so in some cases than what they put in theaters.
And Brian, you mentioned simultaneous releases, you know, putting big films out online and in theaters at the same time. Theaters, I get it, they didn't like that model. Did anyone like it, though? How did those films actually perform?
A lot of the films had dulled box office receipts. King Richard was on HBO Max, came out, I think, in November around Thanksgiving, simultaneous release. It was pretty well viewed online. It didn't get a great box office. We've seen that in other cases as well. Matrix did okay last month, but again, it had that release at home. In the case of Dune, again, I saw that at home. I didn't see that in theaters. It may have dulled, you know, the box office receipts or gross for these films.
I thought Dune was a particularly interesting case study, Brian, because it was like, you know, one of the things that just jumped out to me as we're looking at this 2022 lineup where you've got, you know, a Batman movie and Tom Cruise movies. Like, these are like Avatar 2, which we haven't even mentioned. Like, we've got known entities, and Hollywood always loves a sure thing. At the same time, it's like, I kind of want to go to a theater and just see a big, awesome movie that isn't a thing I've seen before, you know, Jurassic World being yet another thing that's coming out. So Carol, Katie, here's my question for you. Are you more inclined to go see something that's, all, you know, a known entity, or do you want to see something that's totally new from Hollywood in a theater?
I know about
what's the thing that brings you back?
I know about you, Katie. I want to see my dinosaurs up on the big screen. Totally. But I think a known entity, I'm willing to be like, okay, I know that's something I want to see on the big screen. What about you, Katie?
Yeah, you know, I would go in for Cats 2, but in terms of what might get me into the theater again, I mean, I'm terrible at watching movies. I just fall asleep anyway. So I'm probably not the target audience that these theaters are worried about anyway.
What about you, Jill?
Well,
I'll go back. you know, the moment that I can go on a date night and not, you know, be worried about Omicron, like, I will take that option, please. Brian?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really good for Hollywood this year is because of the postponements from COVID, you have this really, really strong slate of big movies. This is really going to test whether people want to come out to the theaters or not, because you have such a robust lineup of well-known content.
Yeah, I'm missing those big cushy seats. You know, you kick back, your feet go up. I'm just going to say. All right, guys, fingers crossed we can get back to those movie theaters more so in 2022. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, and Brian Eckhouse, reporter of Bloomberg News. Catch the year ahead issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com, and also on the Bloomberg Terminal. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
This definitely showed up on our radar today. It's about the many scandals over at Meta, formerly known, of course, as Facebook. And Katie, how some of this may be a bit demoralizing for employees. Wouldn't you think it's the case, especially as they're trying to recruit folks in? It's like,
yeah,
what?
I would think that's pretty difficult on their recruiting team. Did catch my eye that it didn't seem like a lot of the distraction had to do with COVID, which I feel like when we hear about employee morale, it has to do more with COVID than anything else, but not with Meta.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Hey, let's get all the details, though. Bloomberg News tech reporter Kurt Wagner, he put it out there on the Bloomberg. He is on the phone from our San Francisco bureau. So, Kurt, what's exactly going on here? And what's everything that's got so many of those Meta employees down?
Yeah, well, I mean, this has been a couple of years in the making, as I'm sure you both know. Yeah. I mean, you've seen stories, right? First of all, I think the most obvious is there's just a lot more leaks coming from Meta, formerly Facebook, these days. You know, that's usually a sign employees aren't super happy. I think a year and a half ago or so, we saw an actual walkout from employees who were not happy with how the company handled President Trump's post. And then this week, you know, what kind of prompted this, I wrote this in our newsletter this morning, what prompted this was Glassdoor does this ranking of the best places to work. And Facebook is usually in the top 10. In fact, three times it's been the number one place in the world to work. And this year it was 47th. And it was just kind of a reminder that this company that has historically been, you know, the dream job for a lot of people is not really the case anymore. And I think, you know, it's just proof that a lot of the drama and scandals they dealt with over the last couple of years is actually having an impact.
And Kurt, that's exactly what leaped out to me. That, I mean, Meta, formerly known as Facebook, it was the number one company three times to slip to 47. I mean, what happened? Is it just that, you know, Facebook, now Meta, is just a bigger, more publicly out there company? But, I mean, it's just an incredible drop. How do you explain it?
Well, I think, imagine, you know, what it's like to work there, and kind of every 2 months or so, it feels like you are dealing with some kind of scandal that, you know, questions like, am I doing good in the world, right? Like, that is the question that a lot of employees have to ask themselves regularly, and I think that came to a head this year with some of the Facebook papers. You know, we had the Facebook whistleblower who came out and released all kinds of internal documents, and, you know, the CEO is often testifying before Congress. And it's just like a lot of heavy, heavy stuff to think about on a day-to-day basis when you're trying to do your job. And not a lot of jobs have that. And, you know, to Facebook's credit, it's because it's very influential. And that's why a lot of people like to work there. They can have huge impact.
Yeah.
But at the same time, with that impact comes a lot of questions about what that impact is. And I think people struggle with that.
Well, and I also think about, you know, losing employees costs a company something, right? You lose an employee who might have been pretty productive, that led to top and bottom lines gains at the company. It costs a company to recruit, train, and all that good stuff. There are also, though, some workers, like I think about engineers. We've talked about the tightness in the market. Everybody needs, you know, programmers, engineers. I do think about how that might ultimately impact if they can't get engineers. Do they care as much, engineers, about what's going on in terms of morale? And if so, how that might impact Meta's bottom line or the ability to produce new products?
Yeah, I mean, certainly if you can't hire engineers, it's going to be hard to grow, right? I think that's pretty obvious. And I think stereotypically, you often think like, well, the engineering department, probably more than any other team at a tech company, is a little bit more heads down, right? Like, they're just building, they're focused on the code, and they're maybe less impacted by some of the cultural things that happen. But at the same time, I mean, that's a stereotype, and it's not going to be relevant to every person who's there. And if you have a chance to go build something cool at a company that also aligns with your vision, of course you're going to go do that. And I think that's part of the reason we're seeing Facebook lean so heavily into this idea of a metaverse, right? It's something exciting. It's something futuristic. And if you're an engineer and you want to be building, you know, products that are on the cutting edge, well, Facebook made a pretty public stand. Here's what we're building. You know, come join us. And I have to imagine recruiting was a huge part of that.
And so, Kurt, employees, a lot of discontent there, a lot of existential questions there. But what about advertisers? Are they asking the same questions? And have we seen any pullback in spending?
We have not. And that's part of the reason why I thought this kind of angle or this anecdote about the Glassdoor ranking was notable was, you know, for years, we have not really seen a whole lot of anything change with Facebook because of all the stuff going on, right? You keep thinking, well, certainly advertisers are going to pull back, right? Or business is going to slow down as users leave the service. But that hasn't really happened, right? Despite all the bad things that have gone on around Facebook. And so the fact that, you know, employees might be the one area where it's actually having an impact, I think was pretty notable. And I should point out, I mean, Facebook Meta is huge. It has 68,000 employees. So it's not as if nobody wants to work there, right? It's just that at a certain point, it becomes harder and harder to recruit.
Hey, Kurt, just real quickly, 20, 25 seconds here. Does the internal management, the senior management, do they care? Are they looking to make it better? Just quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, a bunch of people actually left last year, a bunch of high-ranking folks, but this has been the fact that you can't hire engineers has been a big issue for Mark Zuckerberg over the last couple of years, so this matters to them immensely, I'm sure.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Hey, Kurt, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Bloomberg News tech reporter Kurt Wagner on the phone from our San Francisco bureau. Shares of Meta down about 1.6% in today's session, but we've seen a lot of big tech under pressure. Stocks down about 2.5% so far in this new year. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just got about 9.5 minutes left in today's trading session, and we are seeing those major equity averages. Doug just talking about them a few moments ago. They are at their lows of the session, so down about 2.5% on the NASDAQ, really feeling the underperformance among those three major equity averages. But the S&P also down about 1.5%. This is ahead, of course, of tomorrow's big banks starting to report earnings. We'll hear from JP Morgan, Citi, so that will certainly help impact the tone of the trade. Let's get to the Drive to the Close. Kate Fettes is with us. She is President and Chief Investment Officer at Grace Capital. They're a Boston-based registered investment advisor. She joins us on the phone from Boston. Kate, nice to have you here with Katie Greifeld and myself. So the market trade, I don't know, it's a volatile one, safe to say. We've seen some losses. We've seen some rallies. What do you think fundamentally might be the tone of the markets as we just get ready to kick off that earnings season?
I think fundamentally, thank you for having me, Carol and
sure.
Katie. Fundamentally, the market is looking to take a pause. It's looking to take a pause because we've had three very strong years. Last year, the market was up 29%. And what's fascinating about it is if you look at how it happened, the market was up 29%. It did better than the Russell 1000 growth and better than the Russell 1000 value. So that tells you that it was a very narrow market. The top 10 companies playing an outsized performance in the market. At the same time, even though the market is a little worried, they're like, oh, we had a big year, we got to calm down. If you think about it, strictly looking at the facts, the S&P 500 PE multiple declined from 41 times a year ago to 28 times currently. So the earnings in the S&P 500 actually grew 45% last year. So things are not quite as dire as if you look at what's going on today, it would appear.
So, Kate, to your point, you know, we've had three big years for the stock market, looking to take a pause now. We're also cruising into the Federal Reserve's liftoff from zero, potentially the first interest rate hikes since 2018. How do you position in that environment? What are you expecting? How is that going to play out?
You know, I think it's hard to guess what the Fed is going to do in a general sense. So I am not someone who likes to make a lot of macro bets. Having said this, clearly, I think the Fed directionally has been very clear with what they want to do. In a general sense, you know, the logic is, well, the Fed's going to raise rates, therefore you should, you know, buy the banks and sell the tech stocks. Fed's going to raise rates, therefore the market's going to go down. Not necessarily. In a general sense, the Fed has proven itself to be quite dovish. I think if you really look at the way it behaves, it's clear that it's not so much about its mandate of full employment and 2% inflation as much as keeping the markets buoyant. So anytime they do anything and the market looks like it's going to react negatively, they back down. At the same time, it's not clear that raising rates will be bad for the markets. Janet Yellen raised rates from actually zero to about 1.5% beginning in 2015. And the Dow Jones went up 70%, did extremely well. Only a person with a better record was Greenspan. Because what happens when you raise rates in the U.S., it's a global market, you're going to attract inflows from Europe and Japan.
Kate, I want to go back to something you said at the top to Katie and me. And you said performance, and I'm looking at some of the notes, too, you shared with our team and our producer. Performance, you said, so concentrated that the S&P 500 performance bested both the Russell 1000 growth and 1000 value indices. You're talking about last year in particular. I just want to confirm that. And then are you saying that that shows that there's a lot more room for gains by other equity plays, maybe not those big cap names, to continue the momentum?
There is a lot more room to continue the momentum. At the same time, because remember, at this point, more than half of the market is being invested passively. People just putting their money blindly into the index funds. So that creates some vulnerability because you think, oh, I'm going to be diversified. I'm just going to buy the S&P 500, not going to use the stock picker. And you don't understand really how vulnerable you are. That 35% of your performance is being controlled by a handful of stocks. So if that handful of stocks stumble, a passive index investor in the S&P will stumble along with it. An active manager, like what we do, where you're actually picking stocks, you could actually have a very good year, despite the market, in an aggregate sense, doing poorly.
And so, Kate, as an active manager, where do you see the most opportunity right now, you know, on the single stock level, but also on a sector level? What looks most attractive?
I'm going to answer that in sort of a long-term and near-term. And, you know, I'm going to contradict myself a little bit from what I said not that long ago, but hey, that's life. On a long-term basis, technology is clearly the place to be. Mm-hmm. If you look at the market, it's very dominated by the big tech players. And actually, we ran this for our annual report. 34% of the S&P 500 has its headquarters in California, another 11% in the Washington state. So technology is an outsized part of the economy, global economy, and that will continue. In the near term, however,
right,
I think energy is actually interesting. We are also ESG investors, so in a general sense, we shy away from most energy, not all energy. And the overall market is very ESG-centric right now. And as a result, you're having an underinvestment in traditional energy. So when you have an underinvestment with the same level of demand you've always had, in the end, globally, we have a growing population, India, Africa.
Right.
You know, we got growing. So energy, I think, is very interesting. We've got a couple of names that we really like.
Just quickly, just got about 20 seconds, Kate.
Oh, okay, I'll go up. Cheniere, I like Cheniere Energy. It yields 5.5%. Mm-hmm. What we like about it is take-or-pay contracts. They sell gas.
Okay.
You got to go.
Yeah, we got to go. That means we're just going to have to come and have you back because we do like talking names. Kate, do have a good rest of the week and a good weekend. Kate Faddis, she's President and Chief Investment Officer over at Grace Capital, on the phone from Boston.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.